Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to another episode of History Hack. I have the wonderful Nina with me again. Nina, it's good to see you. How is it in Brooklyn?
Oh, it's pretty good, you know, getting ready for the holidays. And no snow here, I've heard. You've had some snow there, though, so, you know.
Not anymore. Thankfully, it rained last night, so all the snow has gone. It's now a balmy 11 degrees. I don't have to have any more hot water bottles. But who have we got today, and what are we talking about?
Right. Well, today our guest is John Fraser King. He's a historian and a writer who founded the Shrewsbury Darwin Festival. He's been appointed to Darwin officer for the local authority. And today, Chris, he's here to talk to us about a new book he's written, Charles Darwin in Shrewsbury. John, welcome. It's so good to have you here.
Yeah, thank you for asking me.
So the first thing I need to know is I need to know what a Darwin officer is, because that's... We've never met a Darwin officer before.
Well, I was a Darwin officer. There is a Darwin officer now who's just come into post, a guy called John Hughes. But back in the day, sort of early 2003, I'd started the Darwin Festival. And then it occurred to me that the bicentenary was looming. It was like just a few years away and nobody was prepping for it. So I lobbied the local authority and said, you know, guys, the world's going to come to Shrewsbury in 2009. How are you going to be ready? So, yeah, they claimed to be the first and at that time only local government Darwin officer.
Excellent. I hope there was some good regalia that came with that.
Yeah, there's no bling. You don't get any medals and stuff like that. But you know, yeah, it's a bit disappointing.
But on the other hand, yes, major anniversary, you know, world significance and so on. So excellent. So, of course, we're completely full of questions this morning. Yeah. But could we start by having you tell us a little bit and tell the audience a little bit about how did you become interested in Darwin in the first place? I mean, so many people are, but I always love to ask our authors, you know, what got you started on this? What intrigued you and made you interested?
Yeah, I mean, I confess to knowing hardly anything at all about Charles Darwin. I was at the time at least, I was a presenter on BBC local radio, and I'd get guests in, like I'm your guest. This is great. I'm a guest, but I used to be the presenter doing the interviewing. And a local amateur historian called Henry Quinn came on my show and said, you know, this is the birthplace of Charles Darwin. Why don't we make more of Charles Darwin in Shrewsbury? And I confessed at the time I had no idea. So I basically applied my radio production skills, brought together four or five key people. We met at the headquarters of the Shropshire Wildlife Trust. I said, look, guys, you know, in a few months' time, it's going to be the birthday of Charles Darwin, 12th of February. You all put events on of some kind or other. Do me a favor. Everybody put an event on in the birthday week. Find me 500 quid and I'll print some brochures. And that was the start.
Yeah.
But anything, essentially, what happened then was that the town has struggled, I would say, to find its Darwin story. Okay, so Downhouse in Kent, that's where all the work is done. That's where all the great writing is done. It's where he does all his research. You know, the garden is his laboratory, his children are his eager assistants. What's Shrewsbury's angle? What is Shrewsbury's angle? And And basically, I was charged with finding it. What is the angle? And the bottom line essentially is, you know, as Wordsworth said, the child is the father of the man. What happens to us in our formative years affects who we are, who we become. We can either go with the flow or we can rebel, but you cannot deny that it's cause and effect. Whatever happens to you, the places you go to, the things you're in, things that you see, the experiences you have will form who you are. Now, I'm a bit of a fan of Bourdieu, the French 20th century sociologist. He talks in terms of social and cultural capital.
Right.
Now that's a concept I can get hold of because I understand how lucky I am because of my upbringing. You know, my parents took me to theatre. We went to historical locations. Music was all around the house. All of these things informed who I became. Darwin, interestingly, believes that none of that has any effect.
Oh, that is interesting.
He wrote that he wrote I was born a naturalist. He says that all of that was innate in him. In other words, it was kind of hardwired into his brain. So that's where, with the greatest respect, I would disagree with Charles Darwin.
No, I understand. And I do know from a tiny bit about, you know, his time in Shrewsbury. But and one thing, for example, is that, you know, the house where he was born and grew up, if I've got that correct, is in fact still there. And
yeah,
so
yeah.
You've got an opportunity to, you know, certainly it's well over, 200 years since the man himself was born. Yeah. But in terms of questions of location and what you were saying about Bourdieu and just, you know, material culture and so on, and mm-hmm. what's the landscape like, you know, once you get outside of the actual mountain. I'm fascinated that he does use that as as if sprung from a seashell on the sea.
Yeah, it was an analyst. I think for me, we talk about Charles Darwin being the naturalist on the voyage, the Beagle, and then he moves to Downhouse in Kent and he writes all this stuff. I'm asking, why was Charles Darwin the naturalist on the Beagle?
Right.
Why him and nobody else? He's not a trained naturalist. When he finally selected to be naturalist on the voyage of the Beagle, he isn't a trained naturalist at all. Right. He's not even on the short list when they come up with candidates for it.
Interesting. Yeah, I had forgotten.
Yeah. The other aspect of this is that when the opportunity did come his way, because of his experience, I'm sure we'll get onto this a little bit later on, because of his experiences at university, this opportunity comes his way, he shows it to his father, and his father says, you can't go.
Interesting. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So yeah. Charles Darwin's not going to be the naturalist on the voyage of the Beagle, then, is he? Unless people intercede on his behalf. And the story of Darwin's sort of first 30 years, because he doesn't leave Shrewsbury until he's 27.
Right, right.
The story of his sort of first three decades is all about mentors. I call them Charlie's Angels. these are the people who mentor Darwin. Yeah. These are the people who see something in him that his own father can't.
Mm.
And that's about perspective. And it's really interesting that you have a view of somebody because of your experience of them. But of course, when they're not there, you know, when his son's away, when Charlie's away at university and what have you, his father has no idea what he's doing.
Right.
So there are people who have a completely polar view of Robert's son.
Hmm.
And only because of them does he become the naturalist on the voyage of the Beagle.
Actually, good. So tell us, I'm going to make us come back to Shrewsbury and for those of us, because it is, you know, we are so distant in time and technology from when Darwin was born in 1809. Tell us a little bit about what was Shrewsbury like when Darwin was born? It's, you know, 1809, early in the 19th century. Change is happening. It's on the horizon. But What's Shrewsbury like at that point?
Well, in truth, if Darwin came back today, he wouldn't recognise most of Shrewsbury. The town itself is nestled on a mound of earth in the loop, in a loop of the River Severn. It's almost an island. It's almost an island. In fact, when the Norman conquest happened, William the Conqueror sent one of his trusted knights to go and hold this bit of territory because there were lots of incursions by the Welsh. He was able to put a Mott and Bailey fortification where Shrewsbury Castle presently is, overlooking the only place you could get into town without getting your feet wet. Yeah. So it's small, it's compact, it's narrow alleyways or shuts and passages, as they're called. It is a catalogue of centuries of English architecture, Georgian terraces, Victorian houses, medieval timber framed houses, absolutely beautiful town. Darwin's house, his father built the mount just out of the loop of the river. It has, and I sort of, when I started my work early on with this, I devised a walk around the town. At the time, the mount, Darwin's family home, was actually the offices of the local district valuer. you couldn't get in unless you knocked on the door and asked very nicely if they would let you in.
Interesting.
So I had to find a way of telling Darwin's the story of his early years without even going to his birthplace. And I can do it.
Yeah.
I can do it. I can take you to more buildings, historic buildings, directly related to Darwin's early development in Shrewsbury than you could take me to Stratford-upon-Avon and show me ones related to William Shakespeare's early years. That's how rich the story is. His story is played out on the cobbled streets and the buildings of the town itself. And that, for me, is something quite special. It's also great that it happens to be being born in a lovely town, in a gorgeous county that looks beautiful. So we're kind of doing all right. We lucked out there, I think.
Exactly. So here he is. His family is quite affluent.
Yes.
His mother is a member of the Wedgwood family, and she is herself an heiress, if I remember correctly. She inherits a fairly tiny sum of money when her father dies.
Yeah.
He comes from, you know, his father is the son of a poet and, you know, and a person who's important and famous in his own right.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the fifth of six children. So here he is, he arrives, and it's a beautiful setting. I haven't seen the interior of the house, but, you know, I've seen images of the exterior.
Yeah.
One assumes there are servants, that, you know, the family is affluent and comfortable. And so here he is, he arrives. His parents are older now, though. They don't get married until they're 30 or something, which, while not uncommon perhaps for a gentleman, surprising for a lady. And I know she also does not live very long after he's born.
He's 8 years old when she passes. It's quite sad, really. It's actually a pivotal age for Darwin, because what I was always keen to illustrate was that Shrewsbury's Charles Darwin isn't a balding, bearded, grey old man.
He's an
8 year old boy. Yes. Running around the meadows, collecting bugs and beetles and having the time of his life. That's Shrewsbury's Charles Darwin.
Yes, absolutely. And there's a story in his autobiography, which you mentioned conveniently has been put online, which is wonderful for people like me, is that he gets in trouble for scrumping apples. You know, apples and he gets in trouble in town for trying to get goods without paying for them and all sorts of, you know, schoolboy kind of naughtiness that someone who comes from a fairly illustrious family can get away with.
Yeah. He is born into what you might call privilege, really.
Yes.
And the other thing to understand, really, I mean, you talked about his mother coming into money. There's a lot of money in the family. In fact, you know, the cousins keep marrying. They keep the money. Right. They keep the money in the family. Yeah. So when Darwin's when he's in Edinburgh and he's supposed to be studying to become a doctor with his brother, also called Erasmus, they quickly work out that they will be coming into money. And I don't mean when Papa dies. They're going to come into money. That's it, literally. there's a tradition of saying, okay, when you marry, we will buy your house for you.
Exactly.
He doesn't have to do a jot of work for the rest of his life. There's no need to do that. In fact, talking about his brother Erasmus, Erasmus was studying to be a doctor. Darwin says, I didn't believe for a moment he would ever practice. When Erasmus left Edinburgh, he began to practice a bit as a doctor. His heart wasn't really in it. He had some health problems. So his father says, okay, well, I'll set you up. You can retire. He's 26.
Wow.
Erasmus Darwin, Darwin's brother, retires in his mid-20s.
Yeah.
So you could say that Darwin didn't need to do anything. There was no compunction. He wasn't compelled to do anything at all. His father didn't want him to become part of the idle rich, so he wanted him to have a profession because it was a matter of family pride. So what wealth and privilege and comfort give Darwin specifically is an opportunity to explore his passions.
And because of this sort of illustrious legacy, I know we touched very quickly on the fact that, you know, his mother is Wedgwood, his grandfather is a poet, but are we missing other people in the family who we should know about, sort of as this, you know, that gives him, you know, the background that there are family traditions and family sorts of just sort of his identity as a member of, you know, the Wedgwood family, as a member of the Darwin family and so on.
Let's go back to his grandparents' generation. Erasmus Darwin was the founding father of the Lunar Society. You know,
highly intellectual, learned, extremely important. Exactly.
They are Josiah Wedgwood, Erasmus Darwin, Matthew Boulton, William Withering, who actually was born in the town where I live. You know, the guy who made the Foxglove into Digitalis and gave us heart medicine.
Right. Yeah.
But these were polymaths. They fascinate me, these people. They were all men, but there we go. That's something of the age, unfortunately. We forget too quickly, history forgets too quickly, that the contribution of women to science. But anyway, they are polymaths. They are interested in all sorts of things. They're self-taught in lots of things. Joseph Priestley is one of the lunar men, a guy who discovers oxygen and gave us fizzy drinks. He's a lunar man. He's also a Unitarian.
Exactly.
Now here's the thing. You've got, if you combine this, a willingness to be curious, a freedom to ask questions, it becomes almost a culture within the family that it's all right to ask. So the Unitarian faith, his mother, Susanna, takes him to the Unitarian Church, which is still there in Shrewsbury, until he's 8 years old. There's a plaque outside that says that this is a Judeo-Christian tradition open to insights from world faith, reason, and science.
Mm, yeah, it's, very different.
So it's all right to look outside the book.
Yeah.
Okay, you don't take anything as settled or fixed. Mm. You are free to ask. What Darwin wanted, Darwin's interest, there was a huge amount of interest in Darwin's early years around natural history. And many of the natural historians were men of the clergy.
Right.
They were almost felt compelled to record and wonder at God's creation. That's where they were coming from, right? So that was all about saying, isn't all of this wonderful and beautiful and gorgeous and intricate and what have you? Isn't that all fantastic? Darwin is looking at it and saying, but why?
Right. Why is it like this? Yeah.
Why does that look like that? Yeah. How did it come to look like that? And essentially at the heart of the book is a tenet that I kind of developed over a number of years, but trying to distill what made the difference, what made Darwin who he is. One of, and I call them the three pillars, and one of them is nonconformism.
Absolutely.
One of them is that freedom to ask and to question, a belief that you don't have all the answers. And you need to appreciate that you need to look to find them. That's a key one. The other one, I mean, the landscape of Shropshire, apart from being gorgeous, for its size, has a greater variety of geological periods than probably anywhere else in the world. I mean, Peter Tolkill, who wrote a book on the geology of Shropshire, talks about how incredibly varied it is. Now, if you're going to come up with a crazy notion like, evolution, tiny incremental changes over generations and generations and generations, it's complete and utter nonsense if the world isn't as old as we know it to be. And Darwin is born in a county with, I don't know what the latest figure is, I think it's something like 11 of the 13 geological periods. It's insane. It's, you know, we've got sandstone cliffs, we've got Wenlock Edge, which a name that will be familiar to many people from A.E. Housman's Shropshire Lad, is riven with tiny marine fossils from oceans that aren't even here anymore. I can take you to a quarry, a disused quarry, which is a mile and a half from my home, and I will show you a huge slab of rock that is fossilized seabed. It literally ripples of sand.
Wow.
And we are 40, 50, I don't know, miles away from the sea.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, Shropshire has traveled from 60 degrees south of the equator. We've been on a very long journey and we're picking up bits as we go, you know?
So here he is, he's surrounded by all this
visual
stimuli.
Yeah.
Something that is going to feed into, if I understand your earlier point, feed into an intellectual tradition in his family of asking questions, observing the natural world, and having an open mind or asking questions. At the same time, is because he's a privileged young man, he has the freedom to roam around, critters and bugs, and look at plants and. Mm. Look at the, I had no idea that Shrewsbury was that complex geologically. That's just another gift.
It's astounding. You know, we've got, there's volcanic stone, again, just three quarters of a mile from where I'm talking to you now. Pink, beautiful pink, remnants of volcanic activity. There's all of those elements as well. But interestingly, I mean, you talk about the family and the family culture and everything. Darwin's parents kept garden diaries. Right. So these are detailed garden diaries. They were recording the life, the development of their garden. So Darwin was being taught from a very early age to observe and record. Now, you know, that's at the heart of scientific exploration. So he's learning that discipline from a small age. He has an innate curiosity, a burning curiosity to understand the natural world around him. He has permission to ask the questions and to make that exploration. And I'm going to talk about the geology. Geology really is the first formal natural science that Darwin engages with, even though he's not supposed to be doing it. He's at Edinburgh, but he falls in with Robert Grant, who's one of Charlie's angels, one of his mentors, and just goes, right, yes. Geology. That's what I'm gonna do. And so off he goes, and that's the start really of it all. And on all of this fascination, he's following this up, he's attending lectures that he's supposed to attend. Okay, you know, but he doesn't want to be a doctor. But he's also attending all these other lectures, he's finding these people out. He's like a limpet, he clings to these people. When he's at Cambridge University, he attaches himself to John Stevens Henslow. And and Darwin's nickname was the man who walks with Henslow. So he attaches himself to these people and feeds off them, but not to the point that he's a nuisance. They love him for it.
Enjoy.
These are the people who will support him, nurture him, promote him.
Right.
And that's how he gets where he's going. So to some extent, it's a case of it's not what you know, but who you know.
Yes, absolutely. No, I can see that plays a significant role. So I know he does. You know, he goes up with his brother to Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. Before that, though, when he's a young man, what's his early schooling like? Is there anyone that he meets early on who has an influence? anyone that he, you know, that comes up in his later correspondence, or he stays in touch with during those early years, or is he having sort of the average, you know, upper middle class schoolboy experience, and not till later that he becomes intrigued by?
Well, interesting. There's an incident that happens every year on Darwin's birthday, on the 12th of February at noon. We drink a toast to Charles, and we don't drink it at the birthplace. We drink it alongside the Bellstone. Ah. The Bellstone, it's a large boulder, granite boulder. It was possibly at one time used as a parish boundary, but now it stands on a plinth in a courtyard right in the heart of the town of Shrewsbury. Mm. It is an erratic boulder. Mm. So you'd have to travel from Shrewsbury up to the Scottish borders, or at least as far as Cumbria, which is some considerable distance, to find that kind of stone extant in the landscape. An amateur natural historian said to Charles when he was a small boy, because they knew it wasn't from round these parts, but they didn't know how it got there. You know, who heaved that onto the back of a horse and cart and drove it all the way to Shrewsbury? Right. You know, why would you do that? That doesn't seem to make any sense. Mr. Cotton says to Charles Darwin, the world will come to an end before we learn how this stone came to rest here.
Interesting.
That's why we have the toast there, because that basically, for me, that's like a red rag to a bull.
Absolutely.
I was just saying, what do you mean we'll never know? Have you asked? Have you done any investigation?
Yeah.
You know, are you just saying that because you can't be bothered? What? Why? and then, you know, just a few years later, he's in Edinburgh University. He's sitting in a geology lecture where they're talking about the last great ice age. About the passage of or the journey, how the great glaciers, these huge walls of ice, marched across the land and carved out, you know, great valleys and moved stones much bigger than the Bellstone, huge distances. And he remembers back to what Mr. Cotton said to him, and he said, and I marveled at the progress of geology.
Yeah, right.
It's little things like that kind of, they're almost sort of saying, he's saying to himself, I was right. I was right. Yeah. You know what I mean? You know, perceived wisdom might say, oh, no, this is the way we're all going to think. And he's going, no.
That's a great story. That's a terrific story. So he goes up to Edinburgh, and you've talked a little bit about the fact that, you know, although in theory he and his brother are meant to be studying to become doctors, that's not really, you know, neither of them end up doing that. And you've talked a bit about, you know, some of his mentors and his up at Edinburgh and also in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. When he's not at the university, either of them, what is he doing in his free time? Is he, you know, gallivanting about the countryside meeting young ladies? Is he going on walks? What's Charles doing during this period? Because as you noticed, you know, as you noted earlier, rather, you know, he doesn't really leave home until he's, you know, 27.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of time on his hands to pursue things he's interested in. What is he doing in his free time?
He's shooting birds. He is slaughtering the bird population of Shropshire. Pigeons, pheasants, partridge, anything he can aim his musket at. Right. And he's very good at it too.
Right.
Robert Darwin's clientele, apart from some of the townsfolk, are his patients, are many of them are from the landed gentry in these big stately home type, you know, mansions that are sort of satellited all around the town itself. So his social circle, let's call him, say, upper middle class, let's say. But his social circle are the children of the idle rich. Mm-hmm. So he can go and shoot at somebody's estate because they want him to. His first girlfriend, Fanny Owen, her dad thought he was terrific, and she writes to him once and says, it's a shame he didn't come because father really wanted you to come and go shooting with him this weekend. Mm. His uncle, Joss, Josiah Wedgwood II, lives at Mayor Hall, which is still there. It's just across the border into Staffordshire. And Darwin remembers idyllic time spent there, you know, again, shooting and fishing, but also listening to music in the parlour and what have you. When he's at uni, he's having a great time. He's a student. Wow. You know, he says, I fell in with some dissipated youths, he says. they like to drink or two, and they carouse and sing, although Darwin couldn't carry a tune in a bucket, he confesses himself. But he had a good time. There's one occasion when he arranged to meet some chums, some university chums at Barmouth. And they were going to do a little bit of geology because it's fantastic. That's North Wales is fascinating. And he went there after, he went there with Adam Sedgwick from Cambridge University. But, you know, they're all getting themselves togged up and they're going to go marching off and look at flora and fauna. And it dawns on Darwin, it's the first day of the partridge shooting season. So he left them.
Sorry.
He says, I thought myself mad not to take advantage of the first day of the shooting season for whatever other reason. And they're like, okay, dedication to science, whatever. Yeah, he was just a young man. He's a funny guy. There's a Vanity Fair is a historical magazine that was printed in
of course. Yes, I'm familiar.
And there's a wonderful caricature, admittedly, of Darwin in his later years.
Sure.
How does a caricature work? I don't know if you've ever had your caricature done by a cartoonist, but they pick out things about you that and exaggerate them, what have you. And so all the photographs of the elderly Charles Darwin looks really dour and serious. Whoa. But this is a guy who's sitting there, he's sitting in his chair in his study, and he's wrapped his sort of coiled his legs around each other, and he's got the most impish grin you can imagine. He looks like he's just told a filthy joke, and I think this is the thing. I think a lot of this is about just saying, look, he was a human being.
Right.
He was a real person. When he left Shrewsbury School, he was considered an ordinary boy.
Right. Interesting.
This is coming back to perspective now. Yes. And his father agreed. He's just an ordinary boy. Because what was Shrewsbury School at the time? It was the classics. It was learning Homer by rote. He was having to memorize passages of Homer. He's bored, rigid.
Yes.
He's forced to do all this. And when his mind is racing in a different direction, I think there's a lesson here for us when we look at, ADHD or just children who don't appear to want to concentrate in class. It isn't necessarily because they're naughty or that they're not bright. Their mind is working or racing at a different pace to the other pupils in the class. And I think that's what Darwin is. Because, as I say, the reason he didn't want to become a doctor is that an incident happened when he was at a lecture, he witnessed an operation on a small boy, pre-anesthesia.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, there is no anesthesia, and he had to sit there and watch two operations on small children without anesthesia.
Yeah, that would.
And he thought, do you know what? That's really not for me. That's not for me.
I don't want to do this. Yeah.
What he did, I mean, talk about mentors. Well, I'll tell you who he did meet in Edinburgh. He met a guy called John Edmonstone. John Edmonstone was a freed slave. And Edmonstone taught Darwin taxidermy.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
All right.
He paid this guy, I can't remember what it was a few guineas. He said, he writes to his sister and said, it has the benefit of being quite cheap. but actually, he sought John out other than having the lessons. And what that was doing, again, was broadening Darwin's horizons. He was learning more. Josiah Wedgwood the First was a famous abolitionist, very yes. anti-slavery. Yes. On the voyage of the Beagle, Charles has a run-in with Fitzroy. When Fitzroy comes back on board, he just visited a plantation. Mm. And they get into conversation, and he says to Charles, well, I was with the plantation owner who asked the slaves in my presence whether they minded being slaves. And they all said no. And Charles says, well, they would say that, wouldn't they?
Really? Yeah.
You know, you're there with the plantation. What else are they going to say? The plantation owner's standing beside you. They had a bit of a fallout on that one. They fallout about a few things, actually, but there we go.
Interesting. How close was Darwin to his brothers and sisters? I haven't had the chance to go through the wonderful online collection of letters. Mm. But, I know that you did in order to research and prepare for the book. How did you get a sense of, did he have close relationships? Was there a particular brother or sister or... You know, was this just again another an ordinary boy in a family of six getting into scrapes and being one of the younger ones?
Yeah, there's a bit of everything really, but I mean, okay, so his first tutor was his sister Caroline,
right?
Now that suggests to me, and again, you talk about I mentioned cultural capital and social capital, which is sort of the family unit and the sort of nuclear family and the friends and connections around it, that they're saying, well, look, you know, we're not going to wait until you start school, Charles. Yeah. You're going to start learning now. Mm-hmm. She was doing her best. I mean, I do feel for her because Charles wasn't interested at the time.
I would have been.
But she was doing her best to teach him. And I think she was coming a little bit too strict. And he used to say that if he was going to enter a room and she knew Caroline was already in the room, he'd say, what's she going to blame me for now? So that was a bit of a tricky one. Right. His brother Raz, they were great friends. And at the house, in the outbuildings beside the house, Raz and Charles undertook chemistry experiments.
Ah, yes. Right.
Charles's school chums found out about this and nicknamed him Gas, at least... At least we think that's why they nicknamed him Gas. But he's doing experimentations in chemistry with his brother, and they went together to Edinburgh together, although Erasmus was just finishing as Charles arrived. So there were connections with that, and he wrote to his family regularly. The copious letters on the voyage of the Beagle back home, this is how it's all going and what have you. When his father finally agreed to let him go, I think he thought he hoped, as Uncle Joss said, it would be character building.
Exactly.
But when you think Charles isn't a trained naturalist, he goes on the voyage of the Beagle. He starts sending stuff back, specimens, loads and loads of specimens, sending all this stuff back. Now Charles doesn't know it, but back at Cambridge, people are just beside themselves with excitement.
Yeah.
Oh my, have you seen this stuff that's coming back? Mm-hmm. And at one point, Adam Sedgwick, Darwin went up to on a geology tour with him, but Henslow was his real mentor.
Right.
Sedgwick travels to Shrewsbury while Charles is on the voyage of the Beagle, knocks on the door and introduces himself to Robert Darwin and says something along the lines of, you know, when your son returns, he must take his place amongst the great men of science. And Robert must have thought, Charles, have you got the right house?
Yeah, really. Are you sure you're knocked on the right door? Yeah.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? So it's that sort of understanding. I mean, what when it came to the voyage of the Beagle, basically that you know, Fitzroy wanted to do the circumnavigation of the globe. It wasn't the first time it had been done, but he right. wanted it to have some merit. He wanted a man of science with him.
Right.
And the idea was that they would have a non-paying, an amateur, naturalist right. on board with him. He'd share the cabin with Fitzroy, and actually there's a sort of another ulterior motive here. If you're the captain of a relatively small naval vessel, it's a lonely position. You can't have friends amongst the crew. You can't have friends amongst the officers.
Who
can you sit down and share a glass of Madeira and have a good old chinwag with? So there's an ulterior motive there. So Fitzroy doesn't know anybody in that milieu. He doesn't know anybody in the academic area. So he contacts his friend in the Admiralty, Francis Beaufort, as in the Beaufort scale, empirical right. measure of wind, sure. which is used for the first time on the voyage of the Beagle, by the way. And Beaufort says, well, the only academic person I know is a mathematician at Cambridge, a chap called George Peacock. But I'll happily, you know, pass the message on, and here's what the offer is. And Peacock says, well, I know exactly, I've got two names in mind, but one of them, definitely, this is the guy you want. And his name is John Stevens Henslow. That's who you want for the naturalist on the voyage to the Beagle. Barring him, his brother-in-law, the Reverend Leonard Jennings, is a very keen naturalist. So that's my shortlist for you. That's my shortlist for naturalist on the voyage of the Beagle.
Right, one of these chaps is who you want. Yes,
these are your guys. Now, the offer comes to them, and they both, for various reasons, mostly around responsibilities, professionally into their parish and what have you, say, well, look, we can't go. But here's the thing. Both of them agree on who really should be the candidate for the voyage of the Beagle, because they have both met on many occasions, because Darwin is invited to dinner with Henslow on many occasions. He's sitting there as a sort of a pale young man, surrounded by dons, you know, professors and ministers. These people are like 20 years older than him. And this is, but they see in him a real spark. So that's how the invite comes.
Right.
He's actually with Sedgwick in Wales, at Cymydwell, which is an amazing place, and comes back, and the letter's waiting for him. Mm. But, you know, as I said earlier on, when he shows this to his father, says, you can't go. Look, you didn't do brilliantly at Shrewsbury School. I sent you to Edinburgh and you won't be a doctor. I sent you to Cambridge and you won't be a minister. You won't become a reverend. You know,
right.
sort yourself out. Come right. on, pull yourself together. And says, you can't go. And Darwin has to write and say, I'd really like to come, but my dad says no.
Yeah, right, father.
My father says no. One caveat. Robert says, if you can find someone of common sense who might change my mind, well, we might discuss it again. And Darwin knows exactly who that is. And that's Uncle Joss.
Right.
Josiah Wedgwood. He charges up to Mayor quickly as he can. Joss says, yes, I'll come back and talk to you. Because again, see, Joss has seen a different side of Darwin to Darwin's own father. He sees this engaging young man. He's bright. He's funny. He's full of energy. Joss sees this, so he persuades Robert to change his mind. But Darwin's already said no.
Ah, right. So now he's stuck.
So now he's stuck because the job might have gone. The gig might not be there anymore. So he has to write again. So, remember me? Charles Darwin, yeah, remember? And I said I couldn't go. Dad's changed his mind.
I still go?
And Robert says, well, actually, Robert Fitzroy is into, he's into this sort of that pseudoscience around the shapes of heads and noses and stuff like that.
Yes, exactly.
You know what I mean? Phrenology, is it? And on the basis of that, he didn't think that Darwin was up to the job. But he did change his mind, more out of desperation, because I think he hadn't got anybody else in mind. So if you pull that together, you think, Charles Darwin was the naturalist on the voyage of the Beagle. Yeah, only just.
Yeah, and of course, as everyone who knows something about Darwin knows, that this is the thing, this is the pivotal event that is going to lead to, you know, pretty much everything else for him. If you wanted to leave us with a thought about Darwin's, we've talked about so many great things about, you know, Darwin, literally and figuratively grounded in Shrewsbury, about his family, the traditions of his family, the intervention of his uncle so that he can go on the Beagle, his early life as, you know, kind of an ordinary schoolboy, you know, nobody going, wow, Charlie is really smart, you know. to a certain extent, his early life, while clearly having an impact, having an effect on who he becomes and how he gets opportunities, there is a certain amount of being in the right place at the right time.
Absolutely.
Has an impact. Mm. So I guess my last question is, does he ever return to Shrewsbury? Because of course, you know, he leaves, he marries, establishes himself, as you said, you know, sort of the center of the Darwin cult is in a very different place. Does he ever return to Shrewsbury?
Very, very briefly, one of his sisters, I can't remember her name, but one of his sisters remains at the house, never marries.
Yes.
And then eventually there is a sale. The house is sold and every plant in the garden is sold up in the lots.
Yeah.
It's really sad.
Right, exactly.
Darwin comes back just before that happens, and then that's it then, and he severs all his ties with Shrewsbury.
Right.
You know, I think the thing is, the book is called Charles Darwin in Shrewsbury, The Making of a Marvelous Mind. Right. And I think what I wanted to do, and you could do this exercise with any great figure, is say, okay, well, we know what they did, but how did they get to the place where they could do what they did?
Exactly.
And so coming back to the original ideas, well, who or what is Shrewsbury's Darwin? Shrewsbury's Darwin is a work in progress.
Right. Yeah.
That's what Shrewsbury's Darwin is.
I think that's a terrific way to sum it up. And I've so enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much, John. Greatly appreciated. Chris, would you like to come full circle and our interesting talk today here on History Hack with John Fraser King?
Yeah, John, just to add in that I have really enjoyed it. I've been sat here listening to you. You've mentioned the name of the book. Could you, it's not out yet, is it? Or is it from?
It's published on the 18th of January by Amberley Publishing.
Great.
So hopefully and by the time.
Yeah, and there's an accompanying exhibition at Shrewsbury Museum and Art Gallery for 2 months, which opens at the same time. And it's based on the premise of the book. So it's Shrewsbury putting its best foot forward.
Absolutely.
In that respect.
I'll make sure I plug it on the History Hack social media as well. So yeah, John, thank you ever so much for coming and speaking to us about Darwin. It's been really, really interesting. And thanks very much and good luck with the book.
My absolute pleasure.
Thanks again, John. Lovely to get to talk to you today on History Hack.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.